Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It was the best of times. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
She'll fight on the beaches.
Oh, hey, man. These are the things that made England.
She'll fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello, everyone, and this is David Crowther here, and we are in the second episode of our little mini-series on UK political parties and their impact on British politics. And I have been joined by the person who had the idea originally, actually, and his name is...
Roy Field Brown. I think you'll find that most good ideas come from me when it comes to this dynamic duo, David.
Is that right, Roy Field? Is that right? Well,
absolutely.
Maybe it is.
Absolutely.
I mean, let me be generous and say that it is right. And also, I mean, one of the problems is you're very astringent, which, as you know, means, you know, bitter, twisted, alkaline. And I had to deal with that through my sweetness.
Yeah, it keeps me from ripening, I think. I think
you're already ripe enough. Thank you, Royfield.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Anyway, we did get a bit of feedback. Yes, and Lisa, I think, intimated that you were bringing some rigour back. I think the issue there is, first of all, she spelt Royfield, R-O-I-F-E-L-D, when she should have actually spelt it D-A-V-I-D. Also, that... Also, I think what's going on here is some hatred of heavy metal.
I must admit, as a Brummie, I'm not supposed to be.
I know. I've always
metal,
been outraged by your disloyalty towards it.
And it's supposed to be the soul of the white working class man, isn't it? Heavy metal,
and also the soul of the white middle class man. To be honest, Royfield.
Really?
Well, in my case, yeah.
Heavy metal is a misnomer. It should just be called white noise.
You obviously haven't heard the right guitar solo. Now, the other thing. Moving on, what we were going to do in your original idea for this was that we were going to do different parties all the way through. We're going to try and do that a little bit today, but today we're basically going to do Reform Act to the beginning of democracy, if I can use that as one man, one vote, although we might end a little earlier than that, but let's see how it goes. Now, originally you said to me, why don't you do the Conservative Party? Would you like me to take me through your thought process connected with that decision?
Well, you very much, to me, represent history, tradition, the status quo, the jack heel boot being on the neck of the working class.
And you're the neck of the working class, is that right, Brown?
I'm very much representative of the working classes who are struggling to have their time in the sun. After toiling for centuries for the man, that is me.
Right, you're toiling your way to California and Toronto and Birmingham and Notting Hill, toiler.
There you go.
Anyway, yeah.
There you
so I just there like to say how outraged I am as a man who's never actually voted Tory. Not that I would necessarily not vote Tory if the time was right and so on, but you know, never actually voted Tory. But that's what we were going to do.
But this is very interesting, because the 19th century is a real history of splits, the formation of the Liberal Party, then various schisms of the Liberal Party that invariably then join the Conservatives. So in a way, right, this is very apt. You know, the old Whigs actually are the establishment, aren't they?
They certainly are.
Right. So I put it to you, sir, that you are a Whiggish.
We're not.
I put it to you, sir, you are a Whiggish
Conservative. We're not PMQs now. Right. Anyway, I accept the mantle of, because I am deeply compliant and naturally conservative. You're quite right. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with the aftermath of the Great Reform Act in 1832, which is where we ended. And what we have is a bit of a period where Earl Grey, who'd seen the Reform Act through, still around, there's a bit of to-ing and fro-ing. But what really happens, most importantly, is we get one of, I think, Britain's finer prime ministers, who is Sir Robert Peel, one of the only folks who actually tried to do any good in Ireland, unlike the vast majority of English politicians. Robert Peel is, in a way, a dyed-in-the-wool Whig in terms of principle and thought, not really in terms of social, but I suppose these days you'd call him a Tory wet. So he has plenty of ideas which you might think of as kind of Whiggish. But it's under Peel that we normally see people saying that the Conservative Party starts. And it's at this time, after 1832, that they have, in the 1834 election, you really begin to get the development of party. So one of the significant things in the 1834 election is something called the Tamworth Manifesto. I can never say the Tamworth Manifesto without thinking of the Tamworth Two. Who were the Tamworth Two, just as an aside, Royfield?
David, you've got me.
The Tamworth Two, Royfield, were a couple of pigs that escaped about 15 years ago. And the whole nation was focused on finding the Tamworth Two. That was absolutely fantastic. I love that. Anyway, the Tamworth Manifesto was a campaigning leaflet. We're used now to have people having manifestos and saying, right, this is what we're going to do if we get in power, which is useful because we then know what they're going to studiously ignore and not do when they actually get into power. But the Tamworth Manifesto was the start of Peel saying, right, look, this is what we're going to do if we get into government. Not in a lot of detail, but it's certainly the start of that process. The election in 1841... was the first one, interesting fact, where an opposition triumphed. What had happened all the way up to this in the political process is that the party of government actually always won because they had all the powers of patronage. The prime minister might change, the leader might change because the king might select a different minister or the queen might select a different minister or PM. But in actual fact, the incumbent usually won the election, almost always won the election. With the Great Reform Act, we have many more contested elections and we actually have a parliament, a party coming in. This is the way we expect it to happen now, is that, you know, people will get bored of the old guys, although the thing about this pendulum swing is really not very accurate when you actually look at the facts. But nonetheless, we kind of expect new people to come in, new broom.
Just before you go on, so 1841, we now have Queen Victoria on the throne. But something significant happens under King William, King William the Fourth. Isn't he going to be the last monarch who's going to try and influence Parliament, try and place a minister?
Okay, what William the Fourth does is he tries to put Wellington into office. He can't form an administration. This is all about stopping the Reform Act, isn't it? He tries Robert Peel to go in to try and stop the Reform Act, but Robert Peel won't form an administration. And then he has to be forced to elect, to put in Tory peers, or to threaten it, in order to get the Reform Act through. But you're absolutely right, in principle, William the Fourth is really where we know for sure that it is Parliament that controls the monarch. And actually, Queen Victoria's reign starts off with a Whig, Lord Melbourne, who she absolutely adores, and she doesn't like Robert Peel. But her reign is a key for the final disappearance of royal influence, practical royal influence. I mean, there's influence still, but constitutional power really, really decreases for the monarch under Queen Victoria.
Yeah, and I thought it was just important for us to notice that, really, to really mark that, because we really do talk about it when we have the Hanoverians in, and I said, you know, the Ladybird Book of History will say that the first two Georges weren't that really bothered, so then Parliament takes on many more of the responsibilities, which were those of the monarch. But now we see absolutely the end, don't we, of the monarch really having some serious influence in politics. It's gone.
Absolutely right. Totally agree. So Robert Peel, who replaces Melbourne, much to Victoria's disgust, after the election of 1841. And again, there's another landmark there where the monarch is forced to accept a PM they don't like because of an election specifically, rather than shenanigans going on in Parliament between groups forming and unforming. Peel and Gladstone will be the famous Liberal leader who we'll talk about later. Peel and Gladstone are really very similar. They're in a direct line of succession, really, from the Whigs. So it's confusing that Peel is considered a Tory, but he is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very famous quote about Robert Peel, because his policies were therefore quite Whiggish and quite liberal, with a little L. And there's a very famous quote which gets used for about Disraeli later, actually. So the right honourable gentleman caught the Whigs bathing and walked away with their clothes. He has left them in the full enjoyment of their liberal positions, and he is himself a strict conservative of their garments. What the quote is saying is, actually won the election because he nicked the Whigs' policies. And it's often used about 1867, but it's actually Peel in 1845. The next election.
So Gladstone, and you probably were getting to this, and you did make the link between Peel and Gladstone, and Gladstone was a Peelite, and he's going to be a Peelite who is a Liberal, and he's the real kind of emotional founding of the Liberal Party, though Russell is going to use the term, Lord Russell uses the term, round about this time for the first time, and he really does adopt the name by in 1839, that the Whig Party is the Liberal Party. But it's not officially for another 20-odd years it's going to be used. But what exactly was a Peelite? You've explained kind of emotionally that he's a conservative or he's a Tory. You know, we're in that kind of mix now, aren't we? But he has these liberal clothing. But what exactly does that mean on a practical level? What is the one policy which is, let's say, Peelite? So we can understand why Gladstone will call himself a Peelite as well.
That's quite difficult to answer, because I think a lot of this is about mood, you know, when we talked about the difference between Whig and a Tory and basic attitude. But I would have said that Peel is quite, relatively speaking for the time, is reasonably interventionist. What will define him is the argument between protectionism and free trade, and that will also bring him down. But he does try to reform. He certainly tries in Ireland, for example. So Disraeli dismissed Peel as a man who appointed Tories to office, but then pursued Whig measures. And Disraeli, who was obviously a conservative, would condemn Peel in his memory. I don't know if that's a very good answer, but such is the best I can give you.
No, considering what we're going to come up to, the repeal of the Corn Laws, that makes complete sense.
Okay, so yes, that is indeed what we will come to. As throughout the 19th century, Ireland has a lot of influence, and we have the Great Hunger from in the mid-1840s, and the price of corn is critical to trying to resolve that issue. And as far as the Tories are concerned, they believe that the agricultural interests must be defended, and that is the core of the 19th century Tory party until much later. It's all about the country, agriculture, the gentry. And so they think free trade, getting rid of the Corn Law tariffs, would allow a flood of cheap grain into the country and ruin them. But Peel is a man of principle, and Peel says, no, this is not right. We must repeal the Corn Laws. And he manages to do it with the help of the Whigs. And it's critical to the psyche of political parties thereafter, because this great split, which leaves a rump in the Tory party of the ultras, who are absolutely just gentry, backwoodsmen, that's all that's left of the Conservative Party after that split. And many of the Peelites go into what becomes the Liberal Party, as you've mentioned. And ever since that time, people have been in politics, have been obsessed with splits. So you can see today, everybody is constantly talking about unity. I mean, of course, once in a political party, once you've said we must have unity, you know you're knackered, because nobody asks for unity. If you have to ask for unity, by definition, you haven't got it and you're never going to get it. But the split is absolutely seminal, and it condemns the Tories to decades of opposition. So Darby and Disraeli, Stanley, the Earl of Derby, and a young, new, hopeful Benjamin Disraeli take over the Tory party, and they get a few snippets of government. So in 1852, they actually managed to be in government for about a year or so. But nobody knows who these people are, who Darby and Disraeli are. Who are these people? You know, and the Duke of Wellington famously sat at the back of Parliament. He said, and somebody says, you know, it's the government has been formed by the Earl of Derby and Benjamin Disraeli. And he said, who? Because he was a bit deaf and he didn't recognise them. So the 1852 Conservative government, brief as it was, has always been known to history as the who ministry.
Just before we move on, this repeal of the Corn Laws over tariffs is obviously really important in terms of the formation of Liberals and Tories kind of going forward. And it's really important because it spurs British economic growth in terms of this late Victorian imperial phase around, free trade and not tariffs. But the issue of tariffs was something which is incredibly important all throughout the 19th century. It's one of the issues, the nullification crisis, where South Carolina wants to have tariffs, which leads to the American Civil War. All of these emerging industrialized economies are talking about tariffs, whether you should have them to protect your industries or whether you should release them for specific industries so that there would be free trade. And this is something which is going to really be the rallying call of the Liberal Party going on in the middle and the late 19th century, free trade.
And actually also tariff reform will split the Tories again, the Conservatives again, at the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th, when the argument is about special tariffs to preference empire or not. So again, it's a very strong live issue.
Joseph Chamberlain and all of that. It really does show us that the world back then was on the cusp of globalization as we'd understand it. You know, with goods, whether it's it wasn't necessarily manufactured goods, but with raw goods, commodities being cheaper to source from elsewhere, and how that then would help your domestic economy. And one of the things about the repeal of the Corn Laws, which is really significant, is that it's the top 10%. It is the landed gentry who fundamentally don't do well, those people who own the production of those goods, of corn, of those staples, sorry. But for the rest, the other 90%, they boom because of it. And as you said, this is really key, not only in terms of British history, economic history, but also Irish immigration. You know, that famine in Ireland is going to lead to Irish emigration in Chicago, Detroit, in Australia, etc. You know, and which is only recently just stopped from the island of Ireland. So is Ireland depleted because of that famine?
Yes, and also an awful lot of them come to Britain. And that has a major impact on society, on religion, on society. You know, Liverpool football. Is an Irish town, effectively.
Yeah.
Football.
Well, you know what? And it's funny. People always say Liverpool is an Irish town. Glasgow, because of Rangers and Celtic, which is going to happen about 50 years afterwards. But also Birmingham. It's a massive Irish town, which never really gets talked about.
Is that right?
A third of the white folks in Birmingham are of Irish descent. One third.
Is that why you speak like that? Sorry, have I said the wrong thing?
Moving swiftly on.
Moving swiftly on. That's my rubbish Birmingham accent. Sorry about that. I formally withdraw it. So, yes, absolutely. So the backswordsman, the ultras, Derby and Disraeli are consigned to the back benches, struggle to ever try and form a ministry. And they will, when they do form a ministry, their job will be to try and convince the world that they're actually a credible party of government, which for quite a long time they aren't. Meanwhile, the world is now run by the Whigs for a short period after the split in 1846. Russell is the Whig Prime Minister, and this is really the back end of the life of the Whigs. You alluded to the move from Whig to Liberal, which effectively happens after a man who once was asked at a party, if you were not English, what nationality would you like to be? If you were not English, Royfield, what nationality would you like to be?
Yikes.
Gonna have to hurry.
That's a really tricky one, right? Because I'm quite proud of being Jamaican, English, British, and a bit of a mix-up. I don't know. I'm going to say Italian because I quite like the weather and the food.
Indeed. Well, Viscount Palmerston's answer was, if I was not to be an Englishman, I would want to be an Englishman. It's not a bad answer, is it?
Quote.
I mean, it's a great answer. I mean, it's a bit annoying.
It's a great answer.
For the rest of the world.
It's a great quote.
But it's a good answer. Anyway, so I've mentioned his name there, Viscount Palmerston, who was quite old when he came to office. There is a famous meeting in 1859, I believe, where it is said that the Liberal Party is formed. Whether that's actually true or not, the word liberal, as you were saying, had been used well before that, to be honest, but not in a really formal sense. But from about 1859, it begins to be used in a formal sense. And what's happened is one of those separations and coalescences. In the early 19th century, you had a group of people called the Radicals, William Cobbett, Richard Cobden, John Bright, who had really pushed the Reform Act and afterwards pushed at further reform with Peel. And those Radicals come together with the Whigs and together they form the Liberal Party. And it's the Liberal Party, which probably you might want to take over at this point. You can if you want. They begin to espouse free trade in a big way. So this is where Britain's industrial dominance is really becoming clear. We are now in the heart of the century where Britain economically and indeed politically rules the world. And of course, free trade works delightfully well if you're big and strong. Works less well if you need to protect nascent industry. Free trade works, of course, beautifully for Britain in this situation. So you have a new party and it's led by Viscount Palmerston.
But he still has many Whiggish tendencies. He and Russell are going to be seen as the two terrible old men who, as far as Gladstone and the new, more, let's say, interventionist, if not radical liberals, kind of see them as kind of holding back the full interventionist might and also kind of the moral crusade that the Liberal Party is going to go on, at least an element of the Liberal Party is going to go on in the middle to late 19th century, of which Gladstone is very much kind of the tip of that spear. I once went to a home, a stately home, I was trying to remember the name of it, north of London, where Lord Palmerston, until he was quite old, I think he died around about 80, was a very virile man. Daily he would go for runs and jump over gates, he'd hurdle over them. Sorry. And he would take one or two of the wenches there and have his way with them. And
his wicked way.
He died. His wicked way. His wicked way. And he died whilst in Congress, in mid-wickedness.
Is that right?
Over a pool table. So we were shown the room where it happened, where he expired, whilst pleasuring or a young wench of the village.
Lord!
Lord Palmerston was quite the man. Very virile, but very fit until quite a stately age. However, at the point of climax, the good Lord called him and said, your time's up,
you've had enough,
Palmy.
Come in, boat number.
And,
yes. Okay. Excellent. Well, that's a great story, which I did not know. Was it called Brockett Hall in Hatfield, by any chance?
Yes, there that's exactly Brockett Hall. Brockett Hall. Well done. Which is also famous for, I don't know if it's a descendant of Lord Palmerston. A yuppie back in the late 80s did an insurance fraud, and he had a whole load of Ferrari Testarossas and put them in the lake there, and had the insurance person come round and say, look, they're gone. And this insurance person was just about to sign off on this and give him his money to say that his Ferrari Testarossas have been stolen. And he wandered over to the lake and looked down and saw the red cars in the lake. Yeah. Anyway, Brockett Hall is a great place.
Very good.
It's a great place.
I shall go. Okay, I mean, Palmerston, although he came to office very late in age, and although, as you say, he's always considered, in a sense, a Whig, he did a load of modern things, because what he was that really Whigs weren't, it was intensely populist. He was, as we've just discussed, incredibly patriotic, very energetic. Roy Hattersley said of him that he spoke for England, and in consequence, people loved him. He absolutely played to the gallery. Just like a modern politician, he used written communications to really get in touch and sell the idea of the Liberal Party and his policies. So in that sense, he's quite a modern politician.
I think you made the point at the end of the last episode that the Great Reform Act is going to really change British politics. It brings in the middle classes, doesn't it? The urban classes. And you start to see that with the premiership of Palmerston going onwards. These are people who realise they have to pivot and speak to a different type of Britain. And then also, rising industrialisation means that more people are actually reading and writing and actually really are following the news of the day. And this is important for politicians. You know, they need to get their quotes in newspapers and to help influence public opinion. The middle of the 19th century starts to feel very familiar to us in terms of politics and the feed loop back between newspapers and politicians, etc., speaking to a wider constituency than they ever did before.
Absolutely.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so in 1832, Royfield Brown, a young man, high Tory, whose father had been in the slave trade, comes into Parliament. What is his name? He's the son of a Scot.
Is it Gladstone? Maybe?
It is William Ewart Gladstone. And this means we have arrived at one of those great double acts. You've got, as we know, we've got great double acts throughout history. We've got Little Arch.
Cannon and Ball.
Cannon and Ball. Crowther and Brown. We've also got Gladstone and Disraeli. Obviously, there's more to this than just the rival between Gladstone and Disraeli, but that really has always captured historians' imagination and people at the time, actually, the imagination. Disraeli is the quicker wit, probably nowhere near as fine a man as William Gladstone, but he described beautifully William Gladstone as a man without a single redeeming flaw.
Wow.
Which is just a great line, isn't it? And sums up William Ewart Gladstone. Very, very serious, very, very high-minded, famously Victoria was supposed to have said to him, maybe it's apocryphal, "We are not a public meeting, Mr. Gladstone," because of the way he spoke to her. Always lecturing, always passionate. But a very, very fine man, a very moral man, again, equally famous, given to taking prostitutes off the streets and trying to redeem them.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very religious, but a strong moral sense. A man who said, I had never been able to find the quote, but who said, look, we must look at what we have done in Ireland in the face and put it right. And that will define, in some ways, his career and lead to the end of his career. His career will be wrecked on the rocks of Irish Home Rule and his attempt to put those injustices right. So he's a very fine man, but you wouldn't want to invite him to a dinner party.
Yeah, he did.
The person you would want to invite to a dinner party was Benjamin Disraeli.
Absolutely. Now, just quick question, and I genuinely don't know the answer to this, so I'm not setting you up in a way. We now have the first Asian prime minister, the first non-Christian prime minister in the United Kingdom.
Not our first ethnic minority, though.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly the point. Right. So the first ethnic minority is Disraeli.
Correct.
And many people don't know this. And the clue is in his surname, Disraeli, as to his ethnic origin. It really is there. How was his elevation to the prime ministership seen?
I mean, well, the first thing to say, he manages to get himself into a position of influence because the Conservative Party is absolutely shattered by the Corn Law dispute in 1846. And so there's almost nothing left. There's tumbleweed flying through the Conservative Party. So it's a perfect opportunity for someone with a bit of talent to get involved. He'd also built a career already around writing, and he writes a lot of books, does Benjamin Disraeli. And actually, I read a few at school because I was a goody two-shoes at school, teacher's pet.
You sound rather boring.
Yes, I was extremely boring. Certainly none of my teachers would remember my name from Adam, probably most of the kids either. So he's got a reputation already, and what he builds up is this one-nation Toryism. He talks about it in Sybil, for example. He always faces a background noise of anti-Semitism. You know, there's no doubt that people were aware that his father was a Jew, and that's definitely in the air. But of course, it doesn't stop him getting to that position of power because he's a man of talent and he's a brilliant speaker in Parliament. He's inspirational. And slowly, bit by bit, he and Darby turn the Tory party into a credible party of government. And one of the crucial things that this happens under Russell's, I think it's Russell's government, Gladstone is becoming the powerhouse of that ministry, despite the fact he's not yet PM. And then he becomes PM, does Gladstone, in 1868, I think, is his first ministry. But before that, he tries to get a Reform Act through, because since 1832, there hasn't been any more parliamentary reform. And frankly, the franchise isn't being extended in the UK and we're slipping behind everybody else. You know, the French have had rebellions in 1848. We've had the Chartist movement in 1848, which you may like, we should talk about. But that hasn't led so far to reform, although all the things the Chartist wants, well, five of the four lead, are done well before the end of the century. Anyway, so he introduces a Reform Act. The Conservatives get together and they reject the Reform Act. They do it down. They say, no, we're not going to have this. And then, darn me, if Disraeli doesn't pass a Reform Act, which is very Disraeli. This guy is strong on intelligence and wit, short on principles. So he does this very, very, and this is where the thing about him stealing the Liberals' clothes comes up again. But famously, they then lose the next election. So famously, somebody says that Disraeli introduced the Reform Act, passed the Reform Act, and the country where it said, thank you, Mr. Gladstone, because, you know, they knew, they're not idiots, they knew where this reform would really come from. But it does establish the Conservative Party again as a credible party of government. And Disraeli himself says that the Conservative Party was a national party or nothing. He knew that extending the franchise would do nothing but good for the Conservative Party. We believe, innately, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, that the working classes are going to be more radical. Is that not true?
Absolutely.
But it's not. Disraeli understood this. He understood the innate conservatism of people, and he will capitalise that later in his next ministry in 1874 when he makes, I think it's 1876, when he makes Victoria Empress of India, because he knows what really drives people, and it's not a simple equation. Working class equals radical reformist. He understands that. That's why he's no fear about extending the franchise, and he convinces the Conservative Party of that. Anyway,
no, I think that is a brilliant point for us to understand, because as I said in the previous podcast, one of the things which is going to be the guiding light of the Conservatives, whether you want to call them Tories or Conservatives, but that grouping politically is pragmatism. It's always pragmatic as a way of staving off catastrophe at a later date. You know, so eventually they have to move, they have to change, and they do to stave off social revolution. There's a reason why in the 18th and the 19th century, and let's say even 20th century, Britain doesn't have violent revolution, but it goes through massive societal change. And it's in large part because the party of the vested interest sees which way the wind is blowing and can always make that move just before. And also you're right to point out that we're now going into this high phase of British imperialism. And Disraeli realised that many working class people felt a great pride in that, what was it, a third of the globe, a quarter of the globe is going to be coloured pink on a map. And that gave them a national sense of pride. And that would induce them to, some of them, to actually vote Conservative.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you're absolutely right. The watchword of the Tory party is pragmatism, and you can see the chaos that ensues when they forget that basic fact. The other thing is, I would mention the pendulum swing. You know, we kind of think of, oh, Labour's turn last time, that'll be the Tories, to and fro. And actually, that's not really the pattern. The pattern tends to be bursts of reform followed by quite long periods of conservatism. For example, Clement Attlee, maybe the most influential ministry in modern times, and yet he gets turfed out and replaced by Winston Churchill, a Victorian.
Yeah.
So that's really the model, isn't it? And that's, as you say, the Tories' pragmatism plays a big part in that.
Yeah, and what they don't do, unlike, let's say, some ministries in Europe, is then to rip up the reforms that went before. You know, they see it as the new reality, and that they have to make them work.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. We should do William Gladstone, give him his due, because this is one of the greatest prime ministers of all time, I think, in British history. There is a blizzard of legislation in his ministry, in particular of 1868 to 74, and a blizzard of social legislation. A whole load of reform of trying to deal with the fact that Britain has become a different place, a much more industrial place. And in his second ministry also, that reforming zeal and social and economic and religious reform will keep going.
In terms of like reform, there's going to be the Elementary Education Act of 1870. And it has to be said as well that he is seminal, not only because he almost defines our view of that late Victorian age in terms of his very moralistic and whatever, which wasn't necessarily the mores of the time by any stretch of the imagination. You know, Queen Victoria was famously having loud sex with Prince Albert all over Osborne House and stuff. But we always think of the Victorians as being quite puritanical and, you know, and sex and whatever is, and pleasure is kind of pushed away. But that's definitely Gladstone's MO. But he's going to be prime minister on and off for 30 years. You know, that's another reason why he's just so seminal. Not only does he kind of give us the mores of the time, so he's prime ministership is 1868 to 74, then 1880, he comes back to 1885, a brief time in 1886, and then he has a last hurrah in 1892 to 1994. And he's going to leave the Liberal Party a little bit kind of rudderless when he goes. They don't really know what they are. There are competing factions of imperialists and free traders. And then also with nascent kind of socialists, there are some kind of working class liberals there who were, and the Libs have always had that radical wing, but he seems to be able to put a relative lid on things. But that whole thing of Ireland is always going to be the thing which is going to do, you know, which is always going to be a vein of continuity through his prime ministerships and through his opposition, Ireland and Home Rule, which helps create the Liberal Unionist Party as well. You know, the Liberals are going to splinter many times in the late end of the 19th century.
I was going to read you a couple of quotes actually about Gladstone. One of them is just to give you an idea of how radical.
I love it when I do these things because, you know, you actually come with research. You've got quotes.
It's a shocker, isn't it?
I know.
But you've all got all that stuff in your head. It really irritates me. Just like a mate I used to have at university who basically got a 2-1 by lying in bed having sex with his girlfriend and reading the Ladybird history books.
But you know what, David?
And he got a 2-1 degree, whereas I stayed every minute of my life in the library.
But you know what, David? I didn't get a 2-1. I was kicked out. So anyway, I'm not like your friend at all. I'm not like your friend.
Not like him then. Anyway, you were to me anyway until you just ruined it. So I'll just forget what you said then. Anyway, intelligence isn't about degrees anyway. Anyway, so he supported the London Dockers in the strike of 1889, which is pretty much unthinkable. I mean, he was in opposition at the time, but still. And in his speech, he said, "In the common interests of humanity, this remarkable strike and the results of this strike, which have tended somewhat to strengthen the condition of labour in the face of capital, is the record of what we ought to regard as satisfactory as a real social advance that tends to a fair principle of division of the fruits of industry." Now, I can't find it quite difficult to think of Keir Starmer saying that. You know, that feels a very socialist statement of labour versus capital, which I think is very surprising in the world of Victorian grandees.
Mm.
The other quote is by Disraeli, of course. "We're near the end of Gladstone's first ministry. There's been a blizzard of legislation, so much so that the Liberal ministers have, just for the moment, exhausted all their ideas, and there's a sense of weariness. Dizzy seized on this, and in the House of Commons he points at the front bench and declares, 'You behold a range of exhausted volcanoes. Not a flame flickers on a single pallid crest. But the situation is still dangerous. There are occasional earthquakes and ever and anon the dark rumbling of the sea.'" But, you know, it's a lovely image because they've reformed and they've sort of run out of ideas for a minute. But Disraeli is saying, look, get rid of this lot because they'll be back and there will be more. And so Disraeli takes up the thing of reform, though, as well. And this is one of the strengths of Gladstone, is he's a bit like Jason Robinson. You don't do rugby, D, but Jason Robinson, best fullback England's ever had. And he ran like billy-o. Whenever he got the ball, he just said, right, I'm off. And off he went. And the whole bloody team had to follow him because they knew if they left him behind, the ball would be turned over. Gladstone's a bit like that. He drove reform and everybody had to follow.
Mm.
The Tory party, until Salisbury, who will come to in a minute, had to follow. Anyway, we're taking ages, which is a shocker, so we need to get on, don't we? This is the time where party is really now king. Loyalty to party is as important as your policies, what you believe in, your principles. So this is where we come to a bit of Gilbert O'Sullivan. There's in Iolanthe, there's a rather nice line where it says, "Every boy and every gal that's into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative." England and Britain are now defining themselves about their political allegiance, whether they're a conservative or liberal. You're either one or the other. There is no longer any moving crossbenches without consequences. Party organisation is getting much stronger. Central office is established at this time. The policy of having a chief whip who enforces party and voting discipline, I believe, has now also arrived. Disraeli, again, another quote from Disraeli, said to one young MP, damn your principles, stick to your party. So, you know, absolutely no concept of sticking to your principles. It's your party that counts. Also, a much repeated quote about this time is, England does not love coalitions. And of course, as we know, our political structure does not lend towards coalitions. It favours big parties, first past the post. I'm going to quote Mark Twain at you, since we have to have an American thinker in every episode. And he says, men think they think upon great political questions, and they do, but they think with their party, not independently. Where the party leads, they will follow, whether for right or honour, or through blood and dirt and a mush of mutilated morals. So Mark Twain puts it very nicely, as always, not a fan of what party does to politics. So party politics absolutely rules the roost. Then in 1886, as you have referred to, along with the Irish Home Rule Act, I think there are about four Irish Home Rule Acts, aren't there? The Liberal Party splits. And as you say, the Liberal Unionists, who essentially, in a way, are possibly the old wing of the party, very traditional, they become Liberal Unionists, and they then begin to align with the Conservative Unionists. So you get this great split. This split is the reason I didn't get into York University, because the bloke who interviewed me said, could I think of a time when the parties split on blah, 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 I can't remember what. He had his feet on the table at this point, and he had red socks. So he was a bit of an arse anyway. But anyway, and I went to this one, 1886, when obviously he wanted me to go for 1846. So whack, whack, oops. There could be another reason I didn't get it, but I don't believe so. I think it's the fault of the Liberal Unionists.
Were you wearing like a heavy metal T-shirt, like, you know?
No, I was wearing a suit.
Okay, all right.
I was wearing a suit.
All right.
Good Lord, I was being interviewed for crying aloud. But if I had been wearing my brushed denim rush jacket, I'm sure I'd have been straight in.
Well, you labour under that misapprehension. Anyway.
I don't think I do. Anyway, I didn't get to York University, so that's that. So should we move back to the Conservative Party then? This period of Liberal ascendancy punctuated by Conservative administration. Disraeli has one long ministry. He has, I think, about two or three, a couple of year ones. And then he has one from 1874 to 1880, I think, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Gladstone and the Liberals have essentially, I think, remodeled the British state into one that aimed to serve the interests of all in society. That's what I think Gladstone is often credited with. He himself was a man inspired by Pitt the Younger, who tried very much to do the same, and also a very principled politician. It establishes a neutral civil service. There is, as you've mentioned, social legislation. There is electoral reform, and the Bickham does another Electoral Reform Act. Like Palmerston, but even more so, he's a very visible politician. So there's this very famous Midlothian campaign. And this is people now going to the people, speaking on the hustings, speaking to mass meetings. He's known, I think, as the railway prime minister or something, because he's always on the railway, travelling around the countryside, talking to mass meetings. Number 10, Downing Street, becomes an administration centre, not just a house for the PM. And the PM itself, as a position, becomes the originator of a legislative programme in a way that it possibly hadn't been before. You know, it's Gladstone who drives the concept of what we're going to be about in this particular administration. Very individualised, and it's a bit the same with Disraeli as well. He becomes known as the grand old man later in his career. You know, this is a leviathan, a giant who has dominated politics. Modern admirers, Tony Blair, Jack Straw, just for examples.
Interesting line about the fact that we have the Midlothian election, where Gladstone actually goes out and campaigns and speaks to the hoi polloi, as you called them. Because American politics, if we use that just as a a compare and contrast, had a similar model whereby if you're running to be president, you didn't actually campaign. It was seen as uncouth to be seen campaigning. And not quite at the same time, but in the election of 1896, we're going to have the candidate McKinley actually go out and campaign for the first time. What the Americans used to do, who were running for president, they would just stop at home, and it would be surrogates that would actually go out and talk on their behalf, because Washington sets in place this notion that you reluctantly take up the reins, so to speak. So other people spoke on your behalf. British politics isn't quite like that, but we do kind of mirror this lack of campaigning. But as we've said, through the Great Reform Act and then subsequent reform acts, we have this new burgeoning franchise. We have newspapers talking about politics, and in effect, politicians then addressing editorials in Parliament, etc., which then leads to general campaigning as we'd kind of understand it today. And that is very significant.
So that's Gladstone. Goodbye, Billy, because then he is replaced in the chaos of liberal unionism and Irish Home Rule. He is replaced by a man who is related to Elizabeth I's First Minister, whatever we're going to call him, Secretary of State. Who was?
The Marquess of Salisbury.
He was indeed the Marquess of Salisbury. The original one, of course, was William Cecil. So he's he's part of the same clan. But yes, you answered obviously the right question. He is a man who is the most dyed-in-the-wool conservative you can imagine. And he's in power for a long time. Here is a quote from the Marquess of Salisbury in 1859. Defining conservatism as hostility of radicalism. Incessant, implacable hostility is the essence of conservatism. So this is not a man for compromise with the lefties. In 1879, he was heard to say, whatever happens will be for the worse, and therefore it is in our interests that as little should happen as possible. And this is him on the threshold of a long period in power. So I think Marquess of Salisbury comes to power in 1885 and I think doesn't get chucked out until
1902. His time is going to be punctuated by Gladstone and the Earl of Rosebery. But what is fascinating is just our collective memory, because we do think of Disraeli and we think of Gladstone. And then if you were to ask the average person in the street, if you said, tell me another 19th century politician, they might come up with Palmerston. You know, Palmerston's name is out there in the ether. He was there for a long time and it's almost seems to be lost to our collective memory.
Absolutely. He is also the Prime Minister, though, at the time of the Boer War. And the Boer War was very unpopular, although the Khaki election of 1900 kept him in power when he was under quite a lot of pressure. But the Boer War was not popular in Britain. The Liberal leader called the methods used in the Boer War as the methods of barbarism. For the Liberals, it gave the lie to the high moral tone of empire that had been adopted, you know, that the empire was about civilizing the world, not just a question of power, of money, imperial dominance, whatever. But for Salisbury, this was another conservative issue, that fighting decolonization was an issue for him, as it would be for the conservatives all the way through to the 1960s. Essentially.
And that election is going to see Lloyd George, who's going to be another lion of the Liberal Party, maybe arguably the last true lion, also rail against the Boer War. But we have to kind of mark imperialism, and it's really good that you've brought it up there, because whether you're a Liberal or you are a Conservative, you're pro-Britain going out and painting bits of the globe red. But the Liberals, they're slightly more angsty about it. For them, it's a civilizing mission, whether it's to take Christianity or civilization to the bits of the globe. Where the Tories, the Conservatives are much more like, isn't this kind of great type of thing? But there is this issue around liberalism as to, is this some kind of moral civilizing crusade and stuff? And we see elements of this with whether it is the Boer War or whether it is Irish Home Rule. You know, there's a sense that there is a contradiction there that the Liberals have about personal liberty and then enforcing it on others, which the Conservatives don't necessarily have.
I'm not going to dispute that. I'm not sure I know the answer, but I'll take it as read.
Another thing which kind of defines that is in 1832, when the slave trade is completely abolished in the British Empire, very quickly, Britain becomes the world's policeman around slavery. And what it does is it polices the seas to stop slavery. And as late as 1914, there is a British squadron off the coast of West Africa dissuading would-be slavers. And you can see photographs as late as, let's say, 1908, where a British ship has intercepted a slave ship heading to the Americas and freed African slaves, you know, and taken them back to the coast of Africa. And this is part of this moral conundrum. What are we doing with this empire? And part of it, as far as the Liberals are concerned, is a civilizing mission. And Britain's role in being the foremost anti-slavery power when they abolish it is most definitely evidence of that.
So we are going to leave the story in 1906. Do you have any final closing insights and pearls to cast before us, Roy Field, or should we say goodbye to next time?
I think we've done, really you, have done a wonderful job guiding us through this period of, what, about 70 years. It's seminal in terms of understanding modern British politics. We kind of have two parties who really are truly parties now, go in and out of power, peaceful transfer of power. Something our transatlantic cousins always bang on about. But we absolutely did do that without a big, massive civil war in the middle as well. You know, proper peaceful transfer of power. You know, this is really a time where if you look at it in the mirror of hindsight, is it the mirror of hindsight? In hindsight, you can be a conservative.
I don't know, what could be the mirror of hindsight?
You can be conservative.
You say it as you want it, right, Phil?
You can be a conservative or a liberal and actually say that your party defined this period. We have Imperial Britain or Reforming Britain. And you really do see how the two-party system worked to a degree. But still, what we don't have is complete adult suffrage. And what we do have is a working class who, through industrialization, have more money in its pocket. This is a time when we're going to have something as mundane as fish and chips, which we did a whole episode on, go from being the food of immigrants in London to being the national dish because of the power of the railways. And we have this new working class consciousness, which is brewing up, which starts to be really noticed politically within the liberal wings of politics, but is going to break forth and create its own party and help to define the 20th century. So I think this is an opportune time for us to pause, sir.
Okay, I do want to say one more thing, actually, because in going
so
back to...
So it's not a time for us to pause, because you've got more to say.
It is not a time. Well, it's not a time. It might be a time for you to pause.
Okay, all right.
But I think we haven't done justice. Going back to your point that you were making about the peaceful transfer of power as a regular occurrence, 1848, I think we haven't talked enough about
Chartists.
What we should do in Chartism. Yes. Because 1848 is the year of rebellion and there are revolutions all over Europe. And it affects the UK as well. And the UK has Chartism. And Chartism wants a vote for every man aged 21 years and above of sound mind. A secret ballot, no property qualification for MPs, payment for members, equal constituencies. They also want annual parliaments. They don't win and they disappear. And there is no revolution. But of those six demands that they make in their mass meetings they have, and it's a very terrifying time for the establishment who really think there is going to be a revolution, like elsewhere, like France, for example, all of the things they want become adopted by Parliament. And I think this is a way that British politics works. It is evolution. It takes a bit longer. Mm.
It is interesting that last Representation of the People Act, which is 1884, does see the franchise expanded in the way that the Chartist actually wanted back in 1848. But I must admit, if I was a Chartist, I would think to wait from 1848 to 1884 is too long. I'd be railing against the system. I'd be the most radical of liberals, and I'd be waiting for the Labour Party to be formed and to jump on. Looking back at it, we can see the evolution, but there were a lot of tensions and pressures within British society, and I don't think we should take it as a given that we are immune to violent revolution because we've swerved it on a few occasions, you know.
I'm sure you're right. And having mentioned the Labour Party, that segues nicely into a place to stop. And we will come back to the Labour Party and two world wars in the next episode.
Wait a minute, you made it sound like the Labour Party caused the two world wars.
Oh, did I? Oops. You put me in the Conservative Party seat, pal. You suffer the consequences. Okay, well, with that thought, let's come back next time and see how the Labour Party causes two world wars. So it's goodbye from me.
And this is a goodbye from me. He's chuckling away. A Royful Brand.
And these are the things that made England.
And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.